one of these here. Thank you. How many do I got out there? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. You guys got all your people in? You want more people in? You got everybody in. Yep, I can take all 10. I know you've argued here before, but I'm just going to go over the nonsensical housekeeping rules. Please adjust this to your height. You're pretty tall. It's going to take a second to get up there. We all know that. She knows that. She won't start your time until it's appropriate. You'll have to lower it down for your room. You are comparative to me. Everybody's tall. Just up and down. Take the time to do it. She'll give you the time to do it. Won't start your timer unless you're dilly-dallying. Then she's going to do it because we all want to go home. Good. There's no eating or drinking in here unless I provided it for you. If you have a bottle of water, dump it in a cup before I come back out here with the justices. The reason for that is this microphone only picks up the loudest noise in the room. So be the loudest noise in the room. Okay? The sound goes up and not in. Each one of them have their own speaker, so they can only hear it if you say it into this. Wisconsin I, we are live on both cameras. Yes, you can rewatch it later. That means so can the justices. But if it isn't said into this microphone and you're not pulling it up here and you're not talking like you mean it and you're in it to win it and you do one of these numbers, it's not on the recording. Or if you do one of these or you go to reach for something, this microphone didn't pick you up. When they go to read it, hear it later, you didn't say it. Good? As soon as I walk away, you can go ahead and adjust the podium because you're going to go first, right? Whoa, is this your first time?
Second.
Oh, my God. He's still wet behind the ears. It's good. We'll get him up, though. We'll get him up. Good? Do you have any questions, comments, concerns? Keep your cups on the black. Yeah, you're welcome. Keep your cups on the black mat so that you don't leave a ring. That table got 3,000 pounds right here. For my audience, we're still getting the law clerk situated. I'm Corporal Johnson with the Wisconsin State Capitol Police. My job here today is to get you through this safely, including the justices. They are my primary principal. With that being said, there are a few housekeeping rules we have to go through. Is that better? See the difference? Oh, my goodness. See the difference? I'm just harassing my attorneys. Sorry. They'll probably file charges later. It's fine. Yes, I'm abrasive. Just ask both my ex-husbands. All right. First and foremost, there is no eating or drinking in here, and that includes gum. If you have gum, there is a garbage can out there just beyond the vestibule. Get rid of it.
The taxpayers would be really upset if we allowed you to chew gum or drink or eat in here because this carpet costs approximately $1 million. That is an expensive carpet that we just don't want to have to replace. The taxpayers would be mad, right? And if you're above 18, you get it. Good. If you need to leave and you're in my school group because you have to use the bathroom, you don't feel good or something, just know you are on camera the whole time. Please do not leave in drones. Excuse yourself quietly and then come back. Bathrooms. Women's bathroom, one floor down over here. Men's bathroom, one floor up over here. Unisex bathroom, all the way down to the ground. There is an adult changing table in there if you should so need it. Any questions so far? My adults are allowed to leave whenever they want to because I don't ask you to be here. I don't compel you to be here. My student group, on the other hand, you're here for an hour. That being said, there is no sleeping in here. What happens when you fall asleep and close your eyes? For one, it is the most disrespectful thing you can do for these justices who earned the right to be here, whether you agree with them or not. About $30 million for one of them to sit up here. That is a lot of money. Give them the respect they deserve. But secondly, then you make me have to write a report, and I don't want to. You'll fall asleep, you'll lean forward, you hit your head on the wooden chairs, or you'll slide under the chair, and the whole court will have to stop, and we'll have to leave the room, and then you'll delay the whole court system, and like I said earlier, we all want to go home, right? We got better things to do. If you are feeling so tired you can't keep your eyes open, feel free to step out there if you are a student and wander around. If you're an adult, I don't care where you go. Good. There is no grooming in here. That includes popping your pimples, brushing your hair, braiding your hair, putting it up in a ponytail, braiding your friend's hair. And the fact that I have to say that should make you go, what? It happens, and it does happen, so please don't do it in here, because if you start to bleed and I got to bring you a napkin, then I'm going to be on camera and I only got one good side and that won't be it. All right. I'm going to ask you to stand twice. The first time I'm going to come out of that door, and I'm going to command you to stand. Please be respectful and do so. The second time when the justices say this is over in an hour from now, they will expect you to stand. I'm not going to ask you a second time. Just stand and wait for them to leave. The school group, you will have to stand a third time when she introduces you. There's three of you, actually, so the interns as well, wherever I put them, on the front row. Good. Questions, comments, concerns? Make sure your shoes are all the way on your feet. Anything else? Am I missing anything?
You rock.
Thank you very much. Do I get a raise with that?
Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We are preparing for our second oral argument this morning. But before we begin that, I wanted to say hello to some of the school groups here today. We have Madison West High School. If you could stand. Welcome. Very nice to have you here with us today. Go ahead and have a seat. Pre-Law Society at University of Wisconsin-Madison. Wow, big group.
Look at this.
This is great. I love it when the courtroom is full of students. That's wonderful.
We could admit them to the bar right now and save some time.
It depends if you like the law or not to apply, I guess, and education and all the
other. Until after the hearing.
So maybe you have to wait for a minute. All right, nice to have you here. Go ahead and have a seat. Office of the Governor of Tony Evers, interns. Nice to have you here today. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Great to have such a august group. All right, go ahead and have a seat. After we conclude today, if you have time, Justice Hagedorn will be around to meet with you, and you can not ask questions about the cases, but you can ask him really tough questions, and I hope that you can conjure up some in the process of our oral arguments this morning. Now, turning to the work at hand, Waukesha County versus MAC, 23 AP 533. Could I have your appearances, please? Good morning. All right, the lineup I have is 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, 5 minutes on rebuttal, right? Okay, let's proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Colleen Marion, and I represent MAC, who I'll be referring to as Melissa. Involuntary commitment and forced medication are massive curtailments of personal liberty. The legislature did not authorize trial courts to enter these orders without a person having notice and an opportunity to be heard. In this case, the county failed to give notice to Melissa. And when she did not appear at a hearing that she had no notice of, the trial court forged ahead and entered default orders against her. Melissa's asking for two simple holdings in this case. One, she was entitled to personal notice of the hearing under WISSTAT 5120-10A. And two, default judgment is not permitted in commitment cases.
Whose responsibility was it to keep the court apprised of how and where she could be contacted?
To keep the county notified? Is that what the question was?
Or the court, or whoever would give notice. Yeah. Usually there are requirements, and I think in some of the documents here there are requirements that she provide how she can be.
Sure, yes. I mean, individuals under court orders are expected to keep their whereabouts known. Melissa was homeless. I'll just put that out front and center. But at the same time, I don't see that as central to either of the holdings I'm asking for. Whether or not she was not keeping the county updated of her address, that doesn't obviate the county's responsibility to give her notice. She was under the care.
So you agree it was her responsibility, though, to keep people apprised in this case of her whereabouts, where she can be, what her address would be, or how to contact her, how to give her notice?
That was one of the conditions that was placed on her. I think the county had the primary obligation to do everything in this case because it had care and custody of Melissa. Under 5120-10A, the legislature has specifically stated that within a reasonable time prior to the final hearing, the county, the petitioner's counsel, shall notify the subject individual and his or her counsel of the time and place of the final hearing.
How do you reconcile the two holdings you're asking us to reach with SLL?
How do I reconcile them?
Can you?
I don't think they're reconcilable.
You're asking us.
Yes, I think the court needs to reverse SLL. I don't think there's a way around it, and I certainly think that the court should be doing that in this case.
Can you walk me through your analysis?
Sure. For why SLL is incorrectly decided?
Yes, please.
SOL, and I'll first say, of course, stare decisis is very important, but it's not a straitjacket. Here, SOL is only a few years old. It disrupted the prevailing view of what was permitted in 51 cases. Statute does not provide for default judgment, and so SOL was a sea change, a change course in these cases. And at this point, returning the case law to adherence to the statute would be to correct course. The two big flaws with SOL. First, the court did not comprehensively address the operative statute here, which is 512010A. Instead, the discussion was relegated to a distant footnote, footnote 18. And second, as to default judgment, again, the court was looking outside of Chapter 51 when all of the answers are inside of Chapter 51. The legislature already specified what the procedure should be in these commitment cases, and it specified that the court shall hold a due process hearing, and it set out the outer limit of what the court may do if a person does not appear at a hearing, and that is to issue a detention order.
So can you, I have a question about the detention order and the time limits in the statute. Mm-hmm. So imagine if the hearing is today, the recommitment hearing is today, and the order is going to expire on Friday, but we don't know where your client is, and we don't find your client for a month. By me, I mean the state doesn't find your client for a month. The order would have expired. I think your answer is going to be that there would be some tolling involved, but where does that authority come from?
The answer that I would give is that there is tolling of the time to hold a fine. There's a case, RJO, of the Court of Appeals that discusses tolling. It was reversed in part on a different holding, EJW. But it really just specifically points to the statute. I think the statutory language gives us the answer. This is 512010D, and it states that in the event the subject individual is not detained and fails to appear for the final hearing, the court may issue an order for the subject individual's detention and shall hold the final commitment hearing within 7 days from the time of detention. So it sets forth a new timeline for holding the hearing. Now, I wouldn't say that there's no outer limit to that either. I don't think that a detention order could be in effect for, you know, an entire year or something like that. But that, these are considerations that the court is going to have to weigh when it's being asked to issue a detention order. Because I do want to talk about that word may, because in SOL, a lot of focus was placed on the word may. I agree that the word may means a detention order is discretionary. It is not mandatory. What that means is that the court should be carefully considering the circumstances of the case before it even issues a detention order. For example, if the county walks into court and says, yes, we haven't had any contact with this individual for 11 months, we're not treating them, this commitment is basically meaningless, but you should order a detention because they're not here today in court. I don't think a judge is going to correctly, you know, exercise discretion to issue a detention order. But the legislature made a choice that the detention order is the outer limit on what the court may do in this circumstance. The court may not default the entire case and enter these judgments without the person having their day in court.
What's your best argument for why the court shouldn't default? I mean, the reasoning in SOL is one option. Another option could be default. What's your best argument for why default is not an option?
Well, first, I think that it's not correct to say that default judgment and a detention order are in the same toolbox. Default judgment is not a compliance mechanism. It's a final adjudication of the claim. The reason why default judgment is not available is because the legislature chose not to make it available in commitment and voluntary medication cases. I can think of a lot of policy reasons why these are fundamental constitutional rights that are being lost. I mean, person being injected with medication against their will. I can think of a lot of reasons why, but the important thing is that the legislature made that choice, and there's no basis to stray outside of Chapter 51 to bring in default procedures from a different statute.
So SLL was recently decided, fairly recently, June of 2019. Can we rule for you without overruling that case?
Yes, the court can rule in favor of Melissa without overturning SLL. There are factual differences, and then there's also different legal claims that are raised in the two cases. I'll focus on what the different legal claims are. So part of the backup argument in this case, again, I think default judgment should be off the table. Let's say it is on the table. There are still requirements for what a court must do before it can lawfully enter a default judgment. Most importantly here, the county is still held to meet its burden of proof. So in this case, the county did not put on evidence to meet its burden of proof, and therefore default judgment was improper even if it is somehow available.
So you're saying default judgment can, when you say off the table, just want to make sure I know what off
the table means.
Does that mean reverse SLL?
I think the court should reverse SLL. If the court doesn't reverse SLL and continues to maintain that the default provision of 806025 applies, we still prevail because the conditions, the requirements of that statute were also not met in this case.
So what would you have liked the circuit court judge to do in this case? She queried the defense attorney, who I know had it met with her client, but indicated she thought she'd probably be unlikely to prefer being taken into custody. Tell us what you think should have happened at the circuit court.
I'm just pausing because no one elected me, but if I was the judge, I would have made the county put on some evidence. What did you try to do to find this individual that you have care and custody over to give them notice of this hearing? If they could somehow put on evidence that Melissa, and this is not the case here, knew about the proceeding, was intentionally absenting herself from the proceeding, maybe I would consider whether a detention order was appropriate. The county said, we're not making any efforts. We don't know where this person is, but you should just trust us that a commitment should be entered. I would probably say, no, I'm not going to do a detention order. You don't have an ongoing treatment relationship with this person. I don't think there's grounds for a commitment based on what you're telling me, and this order may expire. But that is not any bar to you coming back on a new petition. If you make contact again and the elements of a commitment can be met. There's no statute of limitations.
Kind of back to the beginning, I guess.
Absolutely.
Then. The court order that case management treatment staff be advised of current address or location, that's not something that the person is required to do under your scenario all of a sudden. The county has to come in and meet the burden, or is it this person's burden to keep them apprised of how he or she would be contacted?
Well, I'll say this. I think that a court can consider all of these factors and circumstances to decide whether a detention order is required. So if the court finds this individual is thwarting this process, they're intentionally not keeping their case manager apprised of the situation, I don't find that to be acceptable. I think a detention order is necessary to bring this person to court. But that doesn't mean that the person, by not, you know, again, she was houseless, but does not maintain satisfactory contact with the department, that she's somehow forfeiting her constitutional right to notice, to freedom from bodily restraint. These can all be factored in terms of the quote-unquote compliance mechanisms. I also did want to point out that the county has its own compliance mechanisms during a commitment, and it was using them in Melissa's case. multiple times.
I think of a variety of cases, though, where a person is court-ordered to keep people apprised. And the practical reality of that is then you know how to tell people about their court dates, their hearings. You can make sure they get notice. And it's not the court's obligation to keep track of that. It's the person's obligation to keep the court or the county apprised of that so that they can be properly informed of dates. So, I mean, there's a real practical reality to having someone be responsible for letting the people involved in a case know how to get a hold of them. But what I'm hearing you say is, yeah, that's a consideration, even though it's a court order to do that. But instead, the county should have to prove that it did a bunch of other things before the case can proceed.
Yes, I think that the county has to prove that it made significant efforts to convince a judge to issue a detention order, and in no event should the court be defaulting somebody for not having their address on file. I don't know if this is a good time to pause, talk about gamesmanship. I really want to talk about it. And I have three things to say about it. First, there's no evidence whatsoever that Melissa was doing anything to thwart these proceedings, to evade the court order, to do anything nefarious to prevent these proceedings from going forward. Second, what I just said is that, you know, if the county comes in and says, this person, they know what's going on, we've tried to serve them, they're not allowing us to serve them, the court can say, okay, well, then I'm doing a detention order. But third, I find this argument so cynical and stigmatizing of mentally ill individuals. These people are our family members, our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers. And to assume that individuals under commitments are going to be trying to, like, wiggle their way out of court orders nefariously just because they don't like the court order is not fair. And it should not be a reason why this court gives the county the ability to take a shortcut to a commitment.
Can you also talk about the involuntary medication order that was imposed here on someone who didn't have notice of the hearing?
Absolutely. Thank you for that. I would also, you know, as an initial point, I think that's a distinguishing feature here from SLL, because in SLL there was a medication order, but it was never discussed as a separate order in the case or having different consequences. And we know that although these orders are often addressed at the same hearing, they're completely separate. Okay, different statutes govern them, different statutory procedures apply, and different liberty interests are at stake.
Are different orders, separate orders also
separate
issues?
Orders of commitment and involuntary medication. An important part of understanding, too, the difference between them is that there's no such thing as an extension of a medication order. SLL focused a lot on the fact that it was a recommitment hearing, an extension of an existing commitment. Every time the county gets a new order of commitment, it files a new petition for involuntary medication. If the person does not have any notice of that petition, I think we're in the area where SLL would have agreed that personal notice is required and no default judgments available. So I think that that's a very important distinction.
And why was the 10A argument not made in SLL?
I don't know. I don't know why it wasn't made by the litigants. It was certainly addressed by the dissent in great detail. And I'm not sure, I'm not sure why the county doesn't discuss it much in their brief. I don't see any way to interpret that statute any other way than requiring personal notice. I mean, why would the legislature have said subject individual and his or her counsel if it didn't mean both?
We have a little bit of debate on this court about, you know, whether dicta, the role of dicta in certain kinds of questions, but that wasn't an issue that was squarely raised. The dissent obviously raised it, you know, as an alternative possibility, and you have the response in footnote 18 of the majority opinion, but arguably at least was not part of the sort of core holding and issues presented by the parties. I think inarguably it was not presented by the parties. And we've got a different kind of a different question, you know, potentially necessitating a different statutory analysis here.
Yes, I think that's true, and I'm not sure I totally understand what the question was, but I do think that like that's a distinguishing factor too. If the court doesn't want to overturn SLL, like that was interpreting an entire different statute. I think it's a little bit. They would sit a little bit uncomfortably alongside each other, but that statute really wasn't the basis for the decision in that case.
Well, I think SLL, you know, distinguishes it because that was about 2B, right, and says that there's some language I've seen in some other things, and we got a certification a couple of years ago from the Court of Appeals that we didn't take, but that also raised, you know, is it problematic in SLL, this language that only, you know, subs 10 through 13 apply. I want to give you an opportunity to address that issue and what clarity you think might be needed, if any, on those kinds of issues.
I would say I don't think that clarifying that point is necessary to the holding in this case, because it's clear that sub 10 does apply to recommitments. So the provision, the really important notice provision, unambiguously applies to recommitments. I think, you know, there is a lot to be said for the argument that more than just 10 through 13 apply for recommitments. You know, there are some provisions that quite obviously apply from other parts of the statute. Sub 3 has the right to counsel. Sub 5 is the due process hearing rights. The substantive standard for commitment is under sub 1. I think that there's really strong arguments for why the statute that was addressed in SLL, sub 2B, does apply to recommitments. The result in terms of notice and default is the same in terms of my argument in this case.
And if we did agree with your, just to make sure I'm understanding, your notice argument, default wouldn't necessarily need to be addressed if this court didn't deem it necessary to do so.
I think that's right. If the court found that the court, you know, that the trial court can't go forward without notice to the individual, then the court doesn't need to reach default. I just want to address, you know, this idea too that allowing the commitment to expire would be some sort of like catastrophic event. The county can always file a new commitment petition, and this court has repeatedly stated that the elements for an original commitment and an extension of commitment are exactly the same. Same quantum of proof, current dangerousness, current treatable mental illness. And I understand the perspective that the recommitment standard is somewhat different because it doesn't require a recent act or omission. But recall that the rationale for that is that there's a continuity of treatment. And that's why the legislature chose to make a slightly different standard in terms of the evidentiary. But in a case where the county does not have contact with an individual, they are not treating them, and they should have to prove an original commitment if there is no continuity of treatment. Because the purpose of the commitment itself is to provide treatment to the person. There's nothing to prevent the county if they, you know, had contact with Melissa, say, how are you doing? I don't think you're doing well. We're concerned about you. We're concerned about safety and your mental illness. We're going to file this petition for a commitment. And that is not an onerous burden to put on the county, and the legislature requires it, the Constitution requires it, and it's wrong for the county to have shortcuts to getting these commitments without giving a person notice, an opportunity to be heard in court. The last point I want to make about the county's burden of proof is I know that there's going to be this argument that because there was SPD-appointed counsel in the courtroom that she forfeited her right to contest the petition. I think that's a completely unreasonable position to take. The county had the burden of proof. It was their choice whether or not to put on witnesses to meet it, and they chose not to. They just asked the court to rely on doctor's reports. Attorney McMahon was candid. She did not have authorization to be objecting or not objecting to matters that she didn't even know what Melissa wanted her to do. It's a very difficult position to put SPD-appointed counsel in. They're not acting as traditional counsel where the individuals walked in and said, I'd like to hire you for my services. They're there because the legislature, SPD, have somebody in the courtroom, but that doesn't mean that they're acting as their agent in the traditional sense. It was the county's burden of proof. If they were going to ask for a default judgment, which is an extraordinary action to ask the court to take, at minimum, they needed to meet their burden of proof to show that Melissa was currently mentally ill and dangerous, and they failed to meet their burden of proof. So the two holdings I'd like the court to reach are quite simple. Personal notice under 512010A and default judgment is not available in commitment cases.
Since you have a yellow light, would you just address stare decisis for a minute? I mean, you know, some members, you know, of this court have spoken very strongly about that. This court as a whole has at various points in time. We're dealing with a statutory question here. Legislature can fix those issues. United States Supreme Court has certainly, I think, taken a view that statutory stare decisis is more important than constitutional questions, precisely because the legislative process can address these issues. So there is an argument here that even if your argument on the merits of SS law was wrongly decided, are correct, that this is an issue for the legislature to fix at this point and clarify. And I want to give you an opportunity to address that.
Okay, I have multiple points. First, the legislature doesn't have anything to fix. Statute's very clear. Second, the court will reverse precedent when it's unsound in principle and unworkable in practice. Here, I've discussed or touched upon why it was unsound in principle, but we also know, we've seen how this plays out after SLL, and it's unworkable in practice too, because it was not presented to the court and thoroughly considered what the actual practical effect will be in cases where we have SPD-appointed counsel. The amicus goes into this in great detail, so I'll spare you. But the third point is often stare decisis is really important to give certainty to the parties and to make sure things are fair. The county is not detrimentally relying on SLL. Every single time it has a relationship with a person under a commitment, it gets to make its decision at that point to give notice, to try at least, to go into court, to make its case. And it doesn't make any sense to me, this idea that we can't disrupt law because it'll somehow disadvantage the county. Every case is its own. And reversing SLL it's what fairness demands, and I would encourage the court to do so.
Thank you. Counsel?
May it please the court. My name is Zachary Bosch, and I represent Waukesha County and the public in this matter. This case is about ensuring that our state continues to be able to provide ongoing and effective treatment to those in our communities who are suffering debilitating mental illnesses that put themselves and our communities at risk, even when they don't want that treatment. We have an obligation to provide that treatment to them. If we allow individuals, intentionally or unintentionally, to absent themselves from that court-ordered treatment and to absent themselves from these processes, we are effectively undermining the state legislature's policy or enacted policy that we provide these individuals with treatment and that we take care of these individuals in our communities.
But counsel, let me just ask you this. The statute's clear that both the individual and her counsel need notice. So why do we need to go even further? Why do we need to go further than that in this analysis in this case?
Justice Protasiewicz, under 10A, it doesn't actually say how that notice is to be provided. Now, opposing counsel has indicated that it should be personal service because of 2B. Unfortunately, 2B doesn't apply. Nowhere in Chapter 51 does it say 2B applies to an extension proceeding. So what SLL did was it reviewed, well, how is that notice to be provided to, in this case, Melissa? And it ruled that because under 10C, civil rules of procedure are incorporated by reference, then we need to look there and see if there's a way that we can provide notice to the individual. And under...
Let me take you to 10C, counsel. The rules of civil procedure can apply except as otherwise provided in this chapter. So going back to 10A, how do you get around the fact that it says shall notify the subject individual and his or her counsel? So just notifying counsel doesn't meet that and provision.
It doesn't, but I will note that opposing counsel in their brief raises the issue that some individuals might be pro se. It's not recommended, let me tell you, in this area of the law.
That's not the facts here.
It's not, but we have to recognize that whatever decision comes out of this court is going to have more effect than just this particular fact scenario. It's going to have a broader effect. So if an individual doesn't have counsel, then certainly we have an obligation to notify that individual.
That doesn't alleviate the duty of notice to both the attorney and the subject of the commitment in 10A. Just because sometimes someone would be pro se and that would be the only person to notify, that doesn't mean that when both are available, you only have to notify the attorney.
And I agree that the statute says the individual and his or her counsel, but it doesn't say how that notice to the individual is to be provided.
What says how? What do you turn to? You're turning to 801.14 sub 2, which is not a notice. That talks about service, providing service. It doesn't talk about notice.
But it provides us a map as to how to provide that notice. This is an ongoing case, a case in which an individual has already appeared in the proceedings. They're already subject to a court order. They're already subject to court-ordered treatment. There's already been findings by the circuit court at the point in time that we're here. This evaluation and recommendation and request for extension is required by the preceding commitment order under the statute. We didn't just decide that we wanted to apply to the court for an extension. We are required to do an evaluation and recommendation.
You're not required to apply for an extension. You're required to do an examination. That doesn't mean you're doing an extension. An extension petition was filed here. And you want to say that somehow that attorney that represented this person initially is still their attorney, what, forever? They never cannot be their attorney?
As long as the case is pending, I believe they have counsel that's appointed to them. No differently than my office is under sub 4, our office, Corporation Counsel, remains in the case through the pendency of the action.
But we always represent the county. I mean, that's your job. Like, that's different. But it would be like saying in a criminal case where someone is sentenced and placed on probation for 10 years, that the defense attorney remains, you'd never be able to terminate representation in these cases.
And how would that work for a non-SVD attorney? When they make a contract to a representation agreement for an individual, they are now saying that you're automatically their attorney until no more extension petitions are filed, and there's a footnote somewhere that says there's a case that was 10 years worth of extension petitions. That's what you want this court to say? In our holding, that this attorney remains on the case forevermore?
Well, the appointment or the referral is to the State Public Defender's Office. And the State Public Defender, I view it almost like a firm, right? They assign attorneys within their firm, if you think of it that way, and they provide that representation. Certainly, those attorneys can change throughout the years, no differently than in Corporation Counsel. I've done this work now for several years, but prior to that, a different attorney did it.
So the firm is what is responsible now? You want the SPD to be the attorney of record?
They would assign an attorney within their firm, yes. I would agree with that.
And while a case is pending, of course, an attorney can withdraw from representation. They're not really stuck with the case forever on.
My apologies, Justice Bradley, for cutting you off. But certainly they could withdraw, and ultimately in this case they didn't withdraw. When you look at the court record, there was no notice of completion, there was no request to withdraw, there was no order discharging representation from the court. And if you look at the actual record, Attorney McMahon remained as counsel of record through the date the petition was filed for the extension of commitment.
And of course, in a criminal case, once it's disposed of and the sentence is rendered, the case is closed, right? So the attorney of record is no longer the attorney of record because the case is closed, but that's not the case in a Chapter 51 case that remains pending.
No, these are civil cases that provide ongoing treatment. And And when we do that evaluation, I agree, Justice Dowd, that we don't have to file an application for extension, but we do have to do the evaluation and recommendation. And if an individual is not ready to go off of commitment, they require that support from the commitment, which can come by way of treatment and other methods, then we do have an obligation to file an application for extension at that point.
So let's go back to the notice, because that's really what matters. This other, it's a very interesting concept that you've given us about what obligations the state public defenders have on these cases, but regardless, we're back to that same provision. So my question is, if we don't think 801.14 sub 2 applies, because we have a specific provision under 10A which requires notice to the individual and his or her counsel, how do you win this case? How does the county prevail?
Well, if 801.14 doesn't apply, then we might have some issues. But the practical effect of that issue is that you're going to have individuals who are now incentivized to not keep their address and contact information up with the courts. And I don't think that's a stigmatization. That's a reality. For those of us that are on the ground working in this area of the law on a regular basis, we regularly have to try to encourage people to come in for treatment. In this case alone, if you look back at the treatment record, the only way she was receiving treatment regularly was through the use of DM orders. The county was constantly having to try to go get her and bring her in for her medication, for her treatment. So to say that it's a stigmatization, it's not. It's a fact. It's a factual reality that we have individuals who do not want treatment, but they are deserving of treatment.
Well, that may be, counsel, but the statute is what the statute is. And we usually try to pay attention to the words of the statute, even if they're not good or they lead to bad consequences. We try to stay away from focusing too much on that. You know, when I look at SLL, it is almost addressing a different question, right? And the argument there was a question over personal jurisdiction, right? So the court goes through and talks about talks about whether you can even render a judgment, right? So this sort of initial notification of a petition, right? I think that's why the argument was focused on sub 2B. And even the court's response in footnote 18 related to 10A is focused entirely almost on this personal jurisdiction question. It says that doesn't change the jurisdictional question. So in some ways, the issue here is sort of a different question. It's not about personal jurisdiction over the individual. It's about required statutory notice prior to the particular hearing. That's at issue here. And that wasn't an issue. That, again, was directly taken up in or presented in SLL. And I guess I'm still not hearing any direct argument as to why the statute, when it says and, doesn't mean the individual and the attorney.
I believe that the county provided notice to Melissa by way of her attorney under 809 or under 801. Now, I recognize that some may not agree that that should be applicable, right. But that's the reality. If this court says 801.14 doesn't apply and that we have to provide notice to the individual and separately to their counsel, then this court has to clarify how that notice is to be provided. And I would offer to this court that personal notice can't be the answer because the state legislature didn't say personal notice.
Why do we have to do that? Why can't we, if you're acknowledging that it wasn't provided, if the statute requires it to both? Why? I mean, I get it. And there are problems here. I'm not trying to minimize that. But we're not necessarily here to solve all of those problems. Why would we have to provide some precise roadmap about what the notice needs to look like?
Because I think we'll be right back here with a different case arguing over what type of notice is ultimately to be provided. And my hope is that this case can put that to rest, as I thought SLL did, but we're back 4 or 5 years later now.
Is it your, prior to SLL, which, again, didn't even address this statute, is it your practice, is it the county's practice, to not provide any notice to individuals? Did they ever do that?
No. In fact, the practice of the county is to try to go above and beyond and to help these people. And we typically try to provide a mailing notice to the individual with the notice of hearing when we have their address. But we don't have the address for Melissa.
Sure.
And she's not alone in that. And thankfully, it's not. We're talking about a very small subset of cases that each county has to deal with where homelessness is at issue. But it is an issue. And those are probably some of the more vulnerable individuals in our communities. They're homeless. They're on the streets. They have less access to resources. We might be their only lifeline to any resources. And in this case, if you look at the evaluation recommendation.
If you can find them to give them the resources, Can't we find them, or can't you find them to either notice them or pick them up if a commitment order is issued?
If a detention order was issued?
Right.
Potentially, but it doesn't solve the issue of whether what we do when the extension or when the current commitment order ends. If we issue a detention order, if the court issues a detention order under 10D, there's nothing there about whether the current commitment order extends beyond that time that it's set to expire, because it's only good, in this case it was good for 12 months, could only be good for 9 months or some other number. But it doesn't say if it tolls the time limits, and I can tell you right now, if we don't clarify that issue, if that's the route the court wants to go, if we don't clarify the tolling of the time limits, again, we're going to be back here on that issue. And so there are a lot of issues in this case, and a lot of them are very much reliant on how the court decides the first issue, decides the second issue, decides the third issue.
And I will not talk about the third. I was going to go to the third issue.
Please.
Are you ready?
Get set.
Okay. You're going to talk. Okay. Let's talk about I'm considering the third issue, which is the sufficiency of the evidence. So I'm talking about here sufficiency of the evidence on the medication order here. I think you have a really, really steep wall to climb here. I'm interested to know what your argument is regarding sufficiency of the evidence on the medication.
So I agree that it's a difficult case, but it's a case that the counties face on a regular basis. And I would offer to you, Justice Krofsky, is how is this different, ultimately, when you look at the legality of it all? When you have an individual that we do know where they are, and they might be in the mental health, the Waukesha County has a mental health center, maybe they're at the mental health center, and they refuse to engage with any of their treatment providers. They refuse to engage in that conversation about the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives of their medications. They completely shut down. And we have that. We have that quite frequently. Are we then precluded, are the doctors then precluded from relying on the treatment record and the records that they have available to them to make those decisions or determinations as to whether somebody is competent to refuse medication?
But you know, that's not the issue before us. I mean, here they never met with her at all, and yet they still gave a medical opinion. I don't know how to square that with the statute. I don't even know how to begin to do that.
So the doctors did review the treatment records, and they can glean their experts in this area. Their doctors regularly rely on treatment records.
Can I just ask one more question? Yeah. That just assumes then that this treatment doesn't work. Then what are we doing here? It just assumes it doesn't work, because if they can look at a treatment order from all time past, and they can say this has been the issue up till now, and even though this person has been medicated, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, now they're homeless. I mean, there's no hope for anyone ever getting out of Chapter 51 commitments. Like we can't accept that.
Well, Justice Krofsky, I'll tell you that the only cases you see are the cases that we have to petition for commitment on. We have plenty of cases that only have one commitment order, and they do really well in that 6 months. And they aren't at. There's no extension request made. You're not, and of course you don't get to see those. And
I did
that.
See them because I was on the circuit court, and I didn't see. There were some I didn't see coming back, but there were some that I did see. And certainly you're right. Up here, we see the ones where I don't know how any. I don't know how some of these individuals are ever going to get out of the 51 doom loop.
And some of these cases are long, and they take a long time, and they require that ongoing treatment. Because the reality is if we don't, the alternative isn't more liberty. They're subject to the mental illness. They're essentially a prisoner in their own mind, depending on what type of mental illness this is. I'm talking about schizophrenia, which has delusions that make you think people are after you at all times, that people have implanted devices in your body. That's not free. That's not liberty. Your entire life is based around that delusion.
I want to talk about the order itself, though, for the involuntary medication. So don't you agree with opposing counsel here that those orders are all separate? That's very different than an extension order.
Yes, agreed.
It's brand new.
Agreed.
So how can a doctor who is supposed to explain the advantages and disadvantages of the medication, who didn't even try, didn't get an opportunity. In the scenario you gave, they can then file a report saying we couldn't even talk to this person. She clearly doesn't understand advantages and disadvantages. Here they haven't even met with her, and they're allowed to rely on a previous order when this is a brand new request for an order. How can the county ask for that with a straight face?
So I don't think that the doctors can rely on the prior order. They can rely on the prior treatment records.
How does that accomplish what's supposed to happen? Because it's a brand new petition for the involuntary medication order that's supposed to explain the advantages and disadvantages and show that this person at that time didn't understand them, because it's a brand new order. Whatever she knew or didn't know in 2022, on the day that that last report was, how can the county actually say that they're going to rely on that for a brand new involuntary medication order?
Because it's the only thing we have to rely on, Justice Dowlett. And I know that's not, I understand your concern.
Not satisfactory. Then you don't get it, right? I mean, well, you're talking about injecting this person with medication.
And I'll provide this to you, that the individual is not without recourse. They can petition to the court to have a reevaluation, to have a reexamination. Under Section 16 of 5120, it's the whole reexamination statute.
Okay, but we're talking about involuntary medication. It's the county's burden. She shouldn't have to do anything. It's the county who wants to establish that she should be involuntarily medicated, right? Do you see a difference between that argument you're making to us and the rest of this, at least? As we talk
clarify
about
clarify that for me. I'm sorry, Justice Dowd.
I don't know. That your steepness of your wall to climb here is a little bit different than some of the other arguments you're making?
Sure. I can admit that, Justice
okay.
Dowd. Absolutely.
Okay. I know you represent the county.
That, but,
okay.
But I do think that there is the practical concern here, though, is that we have individuals that need help. And we can't keep putting up roadblocks after roadblocks to the county being able to provide treatment, effective treatment. We have a continuity of care requirement.
Well, I don't think anybody wants to put up roadblocks. We want to make sure that the statute is complied with. And I want to talk a little bit too more about the sufficiency issue that was brought up by Justice Karofsky. The circuit court made an order in regard to current dangerousness. Was there any evidence in front of the circuit court that supported that finding?
So the court noted that it was relying on the reports of the two doctors that were filed with the court. Those reports ultimately were relying upon the treatment records and specifically the evaluation recommendation that was filed by the county. And within those reports, there is a discussion of the initiating circumstances in this case in which Melissa unfortunately had delusions and was asking, number one, she was in our county jail, she was asking for the correctional officers to kill her. She was providing homicidal ideation, wanting to kill her boyfriend.
And how long ago was that? Because this was a finding of current dangerousness.
That was in 2020, but as counsel noted in her opening arguments, these are extension proceedings, and so the court can rely on the treatment record to prove dangerousness. We don't have to have new dangerousness because the hope is that if we're providing...
Isn't the whole point of an extension hearing to make sure that the person still needs the treatment and medication, and shouldn't we be relying on fresh, current materials?
I disagree, Justice Protasiewicz. Only because if we're doing our jobs correctly, the treatment should be alleviating that dangerousness. If we're providing treatment and they're still actively dangerous and we can't do anything to help them, then we're probably under the wrong statute. Because Chapter 51 is supposed to be helping treat these people and improve their conditions, and they should not still be dangerous. They may still have some delusions, fixed delusions, sure, but as long as we can alleviate that dangerousness, there may not be current new dangerousness. And that's what the extension statute is there for. It's to provide that continuity of care. We don't want to create that revolving door of people cycling up to stability and back down to rock bottom because they aren't receiving that treatment. That is what we are tasked with avoiding by the state legislature. And the reality is the more times these people cycle with their treatment of being stable and not stable, the harder it is to get them back to that higher level of functioning. And we have plenty of cases where we ultimately have to convert them over to a Chapter 54 and 55, guardianship and protective placement, because treatment stops being effective every time we stop treating them. So we have an obligation to these individuals, both statutorily and I think quite frankly morally, as members of our communities, to look out for these individuals and provide them the treatment that they need even when they don't want it.
Counsel, what efforts were made by the county
to locate this individual?
So we knew that she was homeless, suspected that she was homeless in Waukesha County. There had been a number of times over the preceding months when she didn't appear for appointments. We had to utilize the DM orders to have her brought in and receive her and her medications. We attempted to locate her in those various points. There was at one point a belief that she was in the hospital due to a boyfriend having a significant injury. We weren't able to locate her there. She at one time had been at a homeless shelter. She was not there.
Let me be maybe more specific. I have written that I have problems with default judgment in this context, but let's assume that you can have a default judgment. What efforts, though, should the county demonstrate they made to get a default judgment or an order for detention?
I would agree that the county has an obligation to try to find these individuals.
So what are those? Give me, if I were writing an opinion, what are those efforts that the county should make before it seeks a default judgment or an order for detention?
I'll use the really legal term of reasonable efforts, right? Because we all like that word. No, to answer your question, Justin Bradley.
I hear you. You're a man on the ground with regard to your experience here. So I want you to inform me. What do you think is reasonable to expect of a county?
I think we should take a look and see if they're at their last known location, right? If they were in a previous on a homeless shelter, let's take a look. Let's see if they're there. In this case, she wasn't. If we know that there's a particular place in the community that she likes to stay, I think we should take a look there and see if she's there. Absent that, though, I'm not sure what else we can do. Waukesha County is a large footprint, as are a number of other counties in the state. And to say that we have to essentially institute a search party for an individual every time they're subject to an order, that would be a huge burden on the county and on the resources, and we're not actually helping the individual at the end.
In 2012, we had a case in a different context. Someone was convicted for not keeping the government informed about the address. Person was homeless. And the state took the position that if they were on a park bench, they should be reporting the address of the park bench. And one of the things that was considered in that case was the efforts that were made by the individual to find a home, and also, you know, the efforts of government. So that's why I'm asking you.
So in this case, Justice Bradley, the county actually offered Melissa, it was temporary housing, but housing nonetheless, at a local motel. She declined that. Now, if she had accepted that, we certainly would have known where to send her the notice.
Let me just stop. I'm always concerned about the record. Is that in the record?
Yes, it's in the evaluation and recommendation, yes.
Thank you.
That she was offered, I think it was in, don't quote me on this, but I think it was in June or July of 2022, so about a month to 2 months prior to the extension hearing. I think it was a Motel 6 specifically. She declined that. She elected to stay homeless. We don't have the ability or authority to require people to go live somewhere. We don't. We're talking about restricting their liberty. That would be a huge restriction.
At the time that you're going to ask for a default judgment, or at the time you're going to ask for an order of detention, what efforts have to be made, should be made? Tell me. You know, prior to that, I'm not talking about 2 months beforehand. I'm talking about before you go into court, something that's current, contemporary.
I think we should follow up, and as we did here, we should follow up with all of the known, last known contacts, so any known phone numbers, any last known mailing address. If we know where she historically stays, we should check that too. The problem is, as you know, with homelessness, it's fluid. A lot of people, especially in Waukesha County, with Milwaukee County, there's a lot of people that go between the two counties because we have a large population, so people float between the two counties. So it's difficult. The only thing I think we can do is to check all of their last knowns.
What's wrong with your friend's position on the other side, where she says no default's not allowed here, but detention is? And so why not everyone shows up at the first hearing, everyone's there, except in this case, MAC doesn't show up, and the judge says, do you need 2 or 3 days to try to find her? Yes. Hearing's today. You show up again on Friday. MAC, everyone's tried to look. What's everyone done? And then the county could ask for a detention order. What's wrong with that route?
So, Justice Kurofsky, the current thing that's wrong with that, and maybe this court will address it, is what happens when the person isn't picked up until after their commitment order has expired. Does the court still maintain competency and jurisdiction on the case to hear an extension or not? The statute is silent on it. And so if the case is yes, the court can...
Do you disagree with the tolling argument or that was laid out in RJO?
That it would extend to the 7 days past the time that they're detained? I don't disagree. I think that would be acceptable. If that's the route this court decides to go, that's the route this court should go. Because we have to ensure that we can still protect these individuals in our communities. It can't be that the only option is, if we take default off the table, that it's we can detain within the time frames of the commitment order or it's a dismissal.
That's not effective. I don't hear them arguing that. I hear them arguing for the detention order, which actually does appear in the statute. So I just want to be clear. That's what I heard you say. That as far as detention is okay, as far as detention is concerned, you agree that that could be a proper remedy in this case, as long as the tolling that was set forth in RJO is applied.
It could be an option. There is one other issue that I have with detention orders is that we're supposed to keep people in the least restrictive setting. Right? If they can receive outpatient treatment, we're supposed to provide treatment on an outpatient basis. In this case, in Melissa's case, Attorney McMahon from the State Public Defender's Office agreed that Melissa did not require an inpatient level of care. She agreed and advocated
She's not being detained for care. She's being detained so that you can have a hearing.
I agree with that, Justice Kurofsky, but she's still going to be subject to an order of commitment, assuming that the tolling and the time limits extends. She's going to be subject to that, and she's going to be in a treatment facility, in an inpatient level of care.
I understand that, but the judge is going to sign off on that. That won't be what the county's doing. That'll be the judge saying, I am signing this. This person was supposed to be here on Wednesday, didn't show up on Wednesday. We all agreed on Friday. We all came back on Friday. Everyone's looked for her. She's not here. Now it's Friday. Now the judge is going to sign the detention order. That's not the county.
Well, I agree with that, Justice Kurofsky, but ultimately I think the court is still has to be held and comply with the statutes, and the statutes say that we have to keep them in the least restrictive. So I know that that may not be your concern, but it is a concern of mine that we have an obligation to not keep people on an inpatient unit when they don't require an inpatient level of care. Treatment or not, it's a very restrictive setting. It's a locked setting. There are other very mentally ill people on that floor that can be very traumatizing for an individual, especially if they've gotten to a point where they might have some stability in their life, to be detained and taken to an inpatient floor with other significantly mentally ill individuals.
It's interesting that's your argument when on the other side you're saying, but we can default them and we can order psychotropic meds and they don't even have to be in court and the doctors don't even have to examine them and we can rely on reports from who knows how long ago. It just seems that those seem inconsistent to me.
I respectfully disagree, Justice Kurofsky, but...
Counsel, I don't want to cut you off, but your time's about to expire. Did you receive a satisfactory answer to your question?
I think you decided to disagree with me respectfully. Yeah.
I think so. Okay. I have a question about your forfeiture argument. You're arguing that Melissa forfeited her right to, and your light's on, but I think the Chief might give you the opportunity to answer if I'm quick. You're arguing forfeiture of the sufficiency of the evidence argument, but 805.17 sub 4 says in actions tried to the court without a jury, the question of the sufficiency of the evidence to support the findings may be raised on appeal, whether or not the party raising the question has objected in the trial court. This argument was not made by counsel on the other side, but doesn't 805.17 sub 4 apply to preserve the sufficiency of the evidence argument that is being made?
It would, and Chief Justice, do I have permission to...
You may answer.
Thank you.
Briefly.
It would apply, as does 809.30, which requires a post-disposition motion, unless it's sufficiency of the evidence, to be filed prior to any other issues being raised in the appeal. So we have more than just the sufficiency of the evidence issue in this case. There are a whole lot of issues that were brought up on this appeal that were never brought up in the circuit court level, and yet there's an alleged error at the circuit court level. Circuit court wasn't provided the opportunity that's required by statute to try to fix that error if it was, in fact, an error. And so I would offer that that section applies, 80930 applies, and none of these issues are properly before this court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Final?
I just wanted to start with a quick housekeeping matter, which is that this report that the county relies so heavily on, this caseworker's report, this is item 69 that was attached to the petition for recommitment. It's not in evidence. The court did not rely on it. The county could have put on evidence at the hearing about its efforts to notify Melissa. It chose not to. I also want to talk about sort of the practical effect of a decision in this case. The county acknowledges that it is and should be really rare, this kind of circumstance, because what should be happening is the county should be having an ongoing treatment relationship with the individual. The individual's meeting with their case manager regularly. It's not too much to ask for the case manager to be talking to their patient. Look, we think you need to be recommitted. This is why, this is what the process is going to be like. And here, I'm handing you this notice of hearing. It's not too much to ask. The county says, yes, we agree we should be trying. That's all well and good, but nothing, the current law doesn't even require the county to try. So we can't just rely on the county to say, but don't worry, we will. And I hear a lot of, trust us, we know what's best for this person going on. And that's not proper, first of all, because policies for the legislature and we have statutes in place. And second, because how is the court to review that kind of assertion without any evidence to prove up what the county's efforts are? The county also talks about how it could be traumatizing to a person to be put inpatient. I don't disagree, but they were doing it during this commitment. They moved Melissa inpatient. They were detaining her with law enforcement officers to inject her with medication. So what I'm hearing is that they want to be able to do it, but they don't want the court to be able to with a detention order, and that's just wrong. I'm trying not to get too heated, but I'm on the ground, too, because I have these clients. I have relationships with them. I know how this affects them, too. I'm not in here totally detached from reality. It does matter. These are serious cases. But the legislature's given two policies for 51 cases. And this is under 51.001. The county has only talked about the first one, which is basically to provide care for individuals. But the second one, which is no less important, is to protect individual liberties. The legislature's made choices on how to do that. All of the answers are in Chapter 51. There's no need to reach out to other provisions. And I just submit that the clear holdings the court should reach are personal notice is required, 51.2010A. No default judgment. And then I appreciate the pullback to the third issue on the medication order. Let's say we do rely on the doctor's reports, which I don't think the court should. They're not properly in evidence. Even if we do, what we have is, at most, an indication that 4 months prior to the hearing, an advanced nurse prescriber talked to Melissa about one of three medications. There is no evidence of a sufficient explanation of the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives to medications that would even remotely apply, would remotely comply with the statute or with Melanie L. So if the court doesn't have further questions, I will conclude there. Appreciate your time. Yes.
Counsel, lest you be offended, I apologize. I think you're not only on the ground, you're probably well grounded. So.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, as appellate attorneys, we have a little chip on our back about being told we're not on the ground. So I appreciate the time. And
imagine how we feel.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Good oral arguments. For those of you who wish to stay, we'll be out here to speak with you in a few minutes. Thank you for your oral arguments today. We will reconvene at 1:30 in closed conference.